Welcome back to the Rock Chalk Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Mitz. Tonight, we are joined once again by the Commander-in-Chief over there at Rock Chalk Talk, Mike Plank. Mike, how you doing tonight?
Ooh, I like being called Commander-in-Chief, I'll tell you that right now. So I'm going to go ahead and change my title to that, I think.
Yeah, I'm wondering how many different ones I can come up with. So we'll just keep throwing a new one out there every time until we find one that sticks. So.
Okay, I that one has a nice ring to it. I kind of like it, so don't try too hard.
Yeah, it does, but then again, I don't know if you really want people calling you the Trump of Rock Chalk Talk, especially K-State fans. So
maybe we
back off on that one for a little bit at least.
That would be a little unfair, that's true.
Yeah. All right, so obviously we're here to talk about Kansas football. We have you on quite a bit when we talk about KU football, and obviously the big news that's happened recently was Big 12 Media Days. That was Monday and Tuesday of this week. Kansas actually kicked off the event with Les Miles coming first. And while I do want to kind of hit on most of the stuff that he talked about there, I think the biggest reaction to come out of his whole statement was the quote-unquote awkwardness that he had, and it caught a lot of national guys off guard. So first of all, kind of given the content that he was talking about, and what we've seen from him since he got hired, were you as surprised at all that he kind of came off a little bit stilted in his comments?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't have any prior experience with him, obviously. I mean, I didn't watch his pressers at Oklahoma State. I didn't watch his pressers at LSU, so I didn't know really what to expect. But, yeah, and even the local guys seemed a little bit taken aback. Obviously, the KUSports.com kind of glossed over it, sunshine and rainbows. But, Jesse Newell had a pretty fair article, I thought. He had some quotes that Miles, wasn't always smooth and had a few awkward pauses and lost his place more than once, like stuff like that, which was a little unexpected, I would think, especially when he did it like right off the bat. Like it wasn't in the Q&A part. It was during what should have been his prepared statement. And, I mean, he had his notes there. He had papers in front of him. I don't know why he couldn't just read through that. I mean, that seems to be like a basic thing of somebody who's in that type of position. Like you should be able to read a prepared statement and communicate what you need to communicate to the media or what you want to communicate. I mean, he obviously wanted to talk about Puka Williams, maybe hoping he wouldn't get asked about it or something. I don't know. But that seemed to be when he stumbled the most over his words. And then, just throughout the whole thing. Yeah, it's just kind of weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little weird. But, I actually have gone back and looked at a few of his things. And I do remember, because I lived down in SEC territory when, he was still at LSU, kind of the heyday of what he was going through down there. And, what I've noticed about Les Miles is that he seems to be at his best when he can kind of off the cuff, interact with people, use his personality to try to charm guys with the answers to his questions and things like that. This whole prepared statement type of thing, and you could tell it was kind of a hybrid between a full prepared statement where he's just reading it, and that would have sounded really wooden the way that he, delivers those types of things. So instead, it looked like they basically tried to give him talking points, kind of like a basic outline of what he should be doing and then allow him to kind of fill in the extra details and allow him to kind of use that charisma that he has. And it didn't work because you could tell.
Yeah, the statements just never came to it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could tell there was a lot of times it seemed like he wanted to say something and thought better of it and so reminded himself, oh, this is a talking point I need to hit. And like, it was just very disjointed. But I think a lot of that is just because, a lot of people are expecting him to get back to what he did at LSU that made him so popular, kind of the off the cuff, really quick, like joking with guys back and forth and really at ease and just talking with everybody. It takes time to build that rapport with the local guys. And most of the times when he was having that back and forth, it was with the local guys down in Louisiana that he had spent a lot of time with. He knew really well, he knew he could talk to them in a certain way and they would understand what he was saying. There's none of that familiarity yet with Les Miles up here in Kansas. And so it's going to take a while for him to build that. And I think really get to this, Mad Hatter persona that everybody is so used to, because again, he's trying to ease himself back into it. I'm not at all surprised by it. Go ahead.
No, I'm not surprised by it either. I think there's two things that we need to mention there on that topic. And that's One was that the same writers, especially the local writers, mentioned that he did do much better in the smaller group breakout sessions later that day, later that afternoon, when it was just a small group of reporters and it was kind of more bantering type stuff. And then I have also read from some of the more national guys that he is a lot more of, you know, the Mad Hatter type persona, you know, when he's not quite so put on guard and put in front of people, like, for example, following a post-game press conference when emotions are still high and he's still, you know, maybe this sounds bad, but reacting more than thinking, you know, that type of thing, when his natural personality can kind of take over and then come out in those type of situations where, I mean, this is just a canned media appearance here. Go do this, go talk to that guy, make this address to these people, you know, and then go answer some questions, you know, what's the best thing about media day type stuff. So I think that they are a couple different situations.
Oh, and I think that's what we've kind of seen in a lot of the, you know, a lot of the videos that have come out kind of showing him in his element. When he can be natural and can be himself and allow his, I mean, the only way to describe it is his natural charisma to come through, you know, he's exactly what everybody thinks that he was going to be. And he had built that level of familiarity with the local reporters. And you're right. It was like after games where he was, you know, comfortable coming off a big win, or even in uncertain situations, like he was wrapped up in being a football coach and kind of reacting to the game that they just played instead of, you know, trying to hit certain points, trying to make sure he didn't misspeak and say something that he shouldn't have. He just had to focus too much on what he was saying. And so it came off sounding a lot different from the guy that we see in all the sound bites where he's just living it up and reacting to a game that they just played.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So I agree. Obviously, go ahead.
No, I was saying I agree with all that.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously, I think the next thing to talk about is the actual statement itself that kind of started all that off. You know, he came out and said pretty quickly, you know, they have a zero tolerance for any kind of violence against women, which, to be honest, sounds to me like a lot of lip service. Everybody says that, but, you know, if that was true, then anybody who was ever accused would never play again, and that's obviously not really the right way to approach it either. But the rest of the statement talking about how, you know, the coaching staff was not actually involved in making the determination for the suspension, but going in the extra mile and saying that he actually agreed with it, thought it was the right decision there. So I guess I haven't talked to you yet specifically about the punishment for Puka and kind of the reaction to it and everything. Go ahead and take a minute to kind of just talk about that. Like, do you agree with the statement that Miles put out there? Were you satisfied with the way that punishment came through?
I mean, you're right. It's very tricky. And I can appreciate the difficulty, you know, for Miles in his position. According to the reports, according to Bowlesby and, you know, some of the other reports that came out on Monday, a meeting, I guess, of quote unquote higher up university officials, which included athletic director Jeff Long. That's the only one who we know for sure was in this, you know, group of university officials, decided on the one game suspension and informed Miles of their decision. Could Miles have suspended him for an extra game or two? And, you know, for a total of two or three games, I suppose he certainly could have.
Actually, I don't know. To kind of clarify on that, the Big 12 policy, because I went and looked it up, the Big 12 policy is that any punishments related to that have to be done by someone who is not on the coaching staff.
That's what happened.
Like, he could find, you know, little bits and pieces here and there. If he really felt that this was not the appropriate punishment, that they needed additional, he could find, you know, kind of be on lookout to try to find additional ways to suspend him for additional games to kind of send that message, or, you know, make it a little bit more difficult.
I don't know that he would need to do that. I don't know that he needs to go find, you know, hey, you were 30 seconds late to lifting day. He doesn't need to go do that. He can just say, you know what, one game is great, thanks for your work, I'm going to suspend him for three. He could have done that. He's the head football coach.
I mean, I don't think there would be a ton of pushback, especially from like the media, if he decided to say that was a little too hard. But I have to think that there would probably be something internally that would prevent that. And I'm not sure what the conference would say about that. The conference made it sound like,
yeah, I don't know,
any punishment related to these types of incidents cannot come from the coach, whether it's worse or better than what the, you know, there's this independent commission, essentially, as independent as, you know, higher ups at your own university can be. With,
I mean, I get what you're saying, but why would they object to it being worse? That doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, again, I don't know if the conference would actually say anything about it. But
right, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You could couch it as a fairness to the player, you know, say that somebody whose emotions aren't clouded by, you know, being so close to the situation made this determination and you want to go change the punishment, whether it's worse or better, potentially because of, you know, emotional issues, like in terms of the way that it's coming across to you. So
right,
the idea,
yeah,
I think, is to kind of make it an independent, kind of like an arbiter to make a decision on what an appropriate punishment is, and then just defer to that. So, like, well, Miles could theoretically, if he really wanted to, come up with, you know, additional punishments. I doubt he would, kind of to protect whatever integrity the system actually has of trying to at least go somewhat independent from the coaching staff whose jobs, you know, depend on these star players playing well. So now,
I don't
in
know
terms
if they're
of,
counting on winning a bunch of games this year anyway. So
I don't know
if they're counting on winning a bunch of games anyway. So I don't know that while one game suspension or a 3-game suspension really matters. I think with or without him, they win their first two games
really
and they lose to Boston College.
Yeah, I wasn't really talking about the specifics in this particular situation, but I think in general, the conference would want to set it up so that, you know, if there's a guy, you know, if there's a guy who really is kind of struggling, is potentially on the hot seat and like where it would make a difference, they don't want him involved in that decision. You know, or if there's a guy who, you know,
I get what you're saying, but then the conference issue. Then the conference needs to step in and make the suspension and not leave it up to the university, because leaving it up to the university still allows for that perception of a conflict of interest.
True. And ultimately, I do think that that's where we're headed, is that the conference is going to have to step up and, you know, take some sort of role in, if not determining the suspensions on their own, then guiding the schools in what an appropriate suspension would be. Whether that's, you know, have someone from the conference come in and be involved in that decision that ultimately gets made at the school level, or giving clear guidelines on what those suspensions need to be. The main problem that I have, though, with any of this talk about what the, you know, whether it's an appropriate suspension or not, is that, and we talked about this a little bit on the last podcast I did with Scott Chasen, you know, it's hard for us to know these specific details. And a lot of people that are talking about this saying that he didn't get nearly enough, are actually conflating a lot of the different issues. I made a state, or I sent out a tweet or two about this previously, that, you know, domestic violence now has kind of become the buzzword that the minute someone utters it and can, you know, even tangentially relate it to any type of offense, you have tons of people immediately calling for, you know, this player shouldn't have another chance to play again. You know, football is a privilege. You should never get a chance to play. The problem that I have with that is that there are varying degrees of what goes on. You know, the only truly independent, or at least theoretically independent, arbiter of these types of incidents is the court system. And so if the court system, you know, has varying degrees of punishments for this, then we have to allow for the fact that there should be varying degrees of punishments at a university or at an athletics level. Again, I don't want to tell anybody what the right answer is, because honestly, I don't know what the right answer is in terms of the suspension.
Sure.
I easily could have justified a 2 or 3 game suspension, but I can see, given, you know, the details of the diversion, the fact that, you know, they've added other additional things that he has to do at a program level as well. I can see how they got to a 1-game suspension, and you can't honestly tell me that if there had been a 2-game suspension, like a bunch of people probably would have said, oh, well, you know, 2 games, why not 3 or 4? But I don't think a 2-game suspension at the beginning of the year really changes the situation that much. Like, they shouldn't need Puka Williams for a game against Coastal Carolina. So even if it was 2 games,
right,
which I think a lot of people are saying in abstract right now is more appropriate, 2 games, you probably would have still had the same people, oh, well, you didn't do it for any games that matter. And even 3 games, they would have said, oh, well, you only did it for non-conference. Why don't you suspend him for some conference games? So it's like, no matter how much they actually had given him, there was always going to be the calls for people that he should have gotten more. You know, I thought personally the 2 or 3 was probably the right number, just based off of my impressions of the situation. But, you know, again, that's only my impression. Like, if the court system gives him the diversion and, you know, they have all these other stipulations and he's, you know, talked through a lot of this with the people who actually know what's going on, like, I can't say that what they did was wrong. It may not look the best just because, it, you know, the only thing that people really care about is the number of games he doesn't get to play.
Right.
But I have to think that that's not the only punishment that really matters in this case. And so you have to look at everything as a whole, despite the fact that most people don't want to.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily disagree with too much of that. I have had a few interactions on Twitter and through email with, you know, some other, you know, blogs and stuff like that. And if you try and take our bias, I guess, out of it, you know, I can definitely understand people who think that this suspension was not enough.
Right.
You know, I totally get that. But the other side of that coin is something that, especially the more biased fans who are not KU fans, I think you know who I'm talking about, need to look at. You just look at the facts. I mean, the facts are he was immediately suspended. He was completely cut off from the team. No coaching, no workouts, no food tables, none of that stuff. He went through the legal process. He was granted diversion. He completed diversion. He did his community service. The charges are dropped. He's currently on both legal and academic probation, and he's going to miss playing time. And it, when you look at all that stuff, it seems to me like it's pretty typical for a first-time offender. And yes, I know it's domestic violence. I know it's not okay, but it's pretty typical. And maybe it's more of an indictment on, you know, our society, if you want to say that. But I'm not going to disagree with that either. But it's pretty typical for first-time offenders. I don't have a problem with it.
And really, the only other area that I have a problem with in here is that, and national writers have done this too, and I guess in some ways it's kind of understandable because they didn't follow the entire story. But what you typically see in most people that want to criticize the actual punishment, they look at what the initial allegations were, you know, of grabbing someone by the throat and punching them. And that's what they base everything off of, is the initial allegations that came out in a police report. You know, there was additional stipulations of fact. There was additional information that came out that seemed to indicate that maybe what happened. And again, we don't know anything for sure, but based off of the actual,
right,
you know, public records that we have, that it doesn't seem like those things may have actually happened or not. Like, again, we don't know for sure. We weren't there. But based off of the best information we have available at this time, and what he's, what, you know, the facts that he stipulated to, the facts that the prosecution accepted, you know, it was not as egregious of a of an offense as the initial allegations made it seem to be. Again, it doesn't make it right at all in any case, but it also is a little bit more understandable why we got to a less severe punishment than maybe some people think is appropriate. So. All right, I'm going to go ahead and leave that there.
Totally,
I don't want to turn this into another Puka episode. But I do have some more things to talk about that came out of Media Days. But real quick, I do need to throw it to a quick break. We'll be right back on the Rock Chalk Podcast.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. Okay. So obviously I think you're well versed in this. We've seen this happen multiple times in the Big 12 Media Days. You know, the random weird question that seems to be designed to get a gotcha moment from the coach. And Les Miles was the recipient of one of those. Some random guy that, to be honest, sounds like he came from a fake news organization, asked a question of Les Miles of how long is it going to take him to get them in contention for a New Year's Six Bowl. You know, I heard that question and immediately started laughing. And I thought Miles handled that question about as well as you possibly could. So a couple of different things here. What did you think of Miles' answer? And do you agree with me that that was one of those gotcha questions they were trying to get him to say something stupid?
Yeah, it probably was a gotcha question. I don't think there's probably any coach in the league who's dumb enough to try and go ahead and answer it straight up. But is that the one where Miles said, let's try winning a road game in conference first or something to that effect?
No, the actual question verbatim is, Coach, in 2007, Kansas was able to work their way into the BCS, win an Orange Bowl. How many years do you think you need to start competing for New Year's Six? And his answer was essentially just talking about how great that Kansas team was, which was all true. Like, he didn't, you know, talked about how he scouted that Kansas team because, you know, they were a potential opponent for his LSU team that won the national championship that year. So, you know, it's interesting the way he was able to deflect that question. Like, I can't imagine that there was really any better way, but it seems like the Big 12 has one of these every single year. They get, you know, some random guy that comes in and there's two or three. I thought the question was kind of funny. I thought it was a really good way for him to actually answer it, but I just didn't know if you had seen that, if you had any other thoughts about it.
Yeah, I guess I missed that one. I don't know what question I'm thinking of that he answered about winning a road game first, but no, that's interesting. That's good stuff.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it while we're talking about anything else that came out. Couple other things. I guess the final thing that jumped out to me was the final question that they asked him. And it was, let's see, in the short time you've had this job as the coach at the University of Kansas, what are the challenges you have faced and what are the benefits of being the coach at KU? And so real quick, do you remember what his answer was to that? And if not, can you guess what you think he probably said?
No, I don't recall this one either.
I can guarantee you probably have no idea what he actually said, because
I would not care to hazard a guess, yeah.
Well, he immediately started talking about how great of an academic institution Kansas is, and that was the big selling point, that, you know, you can talk about how good of a credential they get when they get a degree, basically completely sidestepping the question about challenges. But answering it in a way that, you know, if the main benefit you can talk about is how good your academic program is, then you probably don't have a lot athletically to really, you know, champion there with going out there. At least he was not like Charlie Weiss and, you know, flat out said, you know, these guys are a pile of crap, so you have plenty of playing time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that was probably the most honest answer, and it was probably the most entertaining answer that you're ever going to see to that, but it definitely didn't do us any favors.
Well, and Miles also said over the, and I don't know, it may have been in the Q&A session, you know, they asked him about how his time at Kansas compares to when he got to Oklahoma State, and
I was sincere.
He has said multiple times that he thinks he has more talent now than he had his first year at Oklahoma State, which is interesting to say the least.
Yeah, so there was a couple different things. They had asked him about, you know, how would you compare what you're inheriting here at KU to what you did in 2001 with OSU? And he actually says he thinks that Kansas itself has a better talent base. So I don't know. It's not quite clear if he's talking about, like, the recruiting area, like where they can pull players from, or if he's talking about the talent that's already in place here at the university. I have to think, just in general, with some of the guys that he's been talking about and been so high on, that I think he's talking about the actual talent that's kind of left here. They don't have as many guys, but they do have some high-end type of guys that have the potential to be playing and performing towards the top of the conference. They just have never been able to put it all together. And, you know, we've had numerous discussions talking about how a lot of that's probably on the coaching staff that we've had previously. You know, Puka is the perfect example of a guy that, you know, even though he did great things last year, he could have been a whole lot better if they had a competent coaching staff that would have put him in better situations. You know, we have multiple guys on the roster that are like that. And so I happen to think that's what he was referring to, that, you know, we're going to get an opportunity to bring in recruits over time to kind of bring the baseline up for everybody. But as it stands right now, they're definitely more talented than their record showed last year. The other question that they kind of asked comparing to Stillwater, you know, was about whether you know, do whatever you can to try to win games now, or you try to build a culture at Kansas. And he, you know, was all in on the whole culture, which I think is what everybody wanted him to say anyway. You know, it's not about doing whatever you can to win as many games as possible this year. It's about getting the culture set up, getting it ready for next year. So that was definitely a big, a big advantage there, a big thing that we definitely wanted to see. The other thing that it was the second last question that he got asked, and I'll ask you for your thoughts on this actual question, because he completely sidestepped the question. Someone asked him about, the stint he has here at Kansas, no matter how long it lasts, how will you look back on your Kansas tenure and define success? And he's basically said, oh, well, we're not looking at that. We're looking at one day at a time. But I want to pose the question to you. You know, if we look at the end of Les Miles' tenure at Kansas, what will he have to do for that to be a successful stint here?
Honestly, he doesn't have to do much. the bar is pretty low. I would think that if anyone is desperate enough for Kansas football content that they're listening to this podcast, that they would probably agree with that assessment. All he really has to do is be competitive, beat K-State once or twice. Don't lose by 40 to, anybody except maybe Oklahoma and Texas anymore. Don't lose to MAC teams. I mean, pretty simple stuff, really. Go to a couple bowl games. Maybe just go to one bowl game in 5 years. It really isn't going to take much to define the era as a success, even if he's only here for 5 years. Let's say he's here for 5 years. He goes to a bowl game in year four, and then he retires after the fifth year. And they're competitive in that year. But, the ball just doesn't bounce their way. They go 4-8 or 5-7 or whatever. It's in such a much better place at that point than it is now, considering the scholarship situation and the roster situation being just kind of the overall talent. I mean, yeah, they've got some really talented guys, but you get to pretty mediocre to below average guys pretty quickly, on this team, I think. Just improve the situation in general in terms of scholarship and talent. Beat the team down the road a couple of times and just generally be competitive. Go to a bowl game or two. Like deep down inside, that's all most Kansas fans want to be, is they want to be not an embarrassment, I think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Kansas fans would love to be much better than not an embarrassment. But
well, sure.
In terms of,
sure.
Like,
but
the
now,
big,
now we know how bad it can
right
be.
Now, well, right. The big goal right now is to stay, to not be a national laughingstock anymore.
Right.
I do think that what is a successful stint for him will depend on how long he's here. Because it's kind of weird, if we can get back to respectability but then stagnate there and Les Miles refuses to move on, I could see people, being grateful for him getting them back to respectability but then saying ultimately he didn't know when to quit. And so saying he's not as successful for that. But, you almost have to think of it in terms of short-term goals and then medium. So short-term goals.
Like a Bill Snyder type of situation.
Well, I'm not imagining that long. But,
the way his tenure ended.
Well, yes. So, just deciding that he's having so much fun doing this, but it's obviously not working. I happen to think just the way that Les Miles is, if he's not being successful, it's probably not going to be nearly as much fun. He's not going to stick around if it's not fun any longer. He was talking about, and I don't think it was just him, but he was talking about, how the 2 years that he had off, him and his daughter Smacker would turn on, a bunch of different TVs all throughout the house, turn on football games, and they would run throughout the house and look at what was going on, and he would give predictions of what plays were coming and just really getting into the analyzing of the other coaches and things like that. So he really enjoys being in the coaching profession and, doing that sort of football analysis and really breaking it down and really diving into all of that. I think if he gets to the point where it's, bogged back down and he's not having any kind of success at all and can't really see the hope for digging out of it, he's not going to be having fun anymore. He's going to find another avenue to kind of, build on that and work on that. And so I'm not expecting him to be like a Bill Snyder, where he's not going to have, some sort of motive of trying to get a particular person hired or trying to hold on for a certain amount of time or anything like that. It's going to be, am I being successful? Am I enjoying what I'm doing? If I'm not being successful, do I see a way that we can get out of it? And if, you know, if all of those are no, then he's not going to stick around. He'll go ahead and retire, and he'll go ahead and hand it off and say, look, I've done everything I can. Please find someone that can, you know, move this forward. So I don't think we're going to run into that type of situation. But, you know, he talked about that he sees it being a minimum of 5 years, which I think is, you know, I mean, that's his contract. So that makes sense. Right, but, you know, right. I fully expect that we will consider that contract to be successful if he's either done enough to warrant extension by year three. So, you know, he gets them to a bowl game pretty quickly. Or if at the end of the 5 years, he has a 500 record. Like, I think like it's that simple. If he can get to a 500 record or be close to it, he doesn't necessarily have to get there if, you know, this year is a tough year and then there's a couple years that he takes into a bowl game. You know, at that point, they're a respectable program again. You know, he can kind of hand it off if he decides to at that point, or if they're still slowly building something, then it would make sense for him to stick around at that point. And so, you know, if he gets that second contract or that extension, then I think the expectations go up a little bit. And ultimately, like at that point, it's already been success compared to where we're at now. But ultimately, how he is viewed depends on what he ends up being able to do long term, or if he decides to step away before it gets to that point.
Well, in a 500 record, yeah, I was gonna say a 500 record would actually be wildly successful considering the history of Kansas football. I went ahead and pulled it up real quick, and you can probably guess who the last coach was to finish with a record of 500 or better.
I'm guessing it was Mangino.
Mark Mangino by two games. He was 50-48. Do you have any idea when the last coach before Mangino finished with a record of 500 and better?
So, trivia time. I actually have no idea. I would get someone like Mason, but I don't think he did well enough, actually. So,
well, he was close. He was seven games under 500. He was 47-54-1. Mike Gottfried was 15-18-1 in the 80s. Don Fambro was 11 games under 500. Pepper Rogers was two games under 500. Jack Mitchell was two games under 500. The last Kansas coach with a winning record was Jules Sykes from 1948 to 1953. So a 500 record would be wildly successful.
So we're talking about like World War II era.
Oh, yeah, right after World War II, yep.
Well, now wait a minute. I just went ahead and pulled it up as well. Are we talking about – oh, okay, that's why. I'm looking at the wrong columns. That would be why. Yeah, so, like, Jack Mitchell got real close. Dang, man, that is a little depressing. I was
– it's very depressing. I'm sad that I pulled it up.
Yeah, so, yeah, even me being optimistic of – so maybe I should change that to not 500 overall, but 500 – for 2 years in a row in a single season. I mean,
yeah, there you go.
Even at that point, that would be an accomplishment. Like, I mean, the idea is to get them back to competing for a bowl game every other year or so.
Right.
Not even necessarily.
Yeah. If he can go 500 over the last 3 years, years three, four, and five, that is a success.
That's super successful. All right. So, we're going to go ahead and throw it to one more quick break. We have a few more things I wanted to talk about before we wrap it up. So we will be right back on the Rock Chalk Podcast. And we're back. Okay, so just a couple different things. You know, the one other kind of revelation to come out of the breakout sessions was the fact that there is actually a clear number one, number two, and potentially number three in the quarterback race at this point. I believe I think it was Michael Swain from Fog.net. It was one of the guys over at Fog.net that talked about, you know, he had said, Les Miles had said that if the season started today, that Thomas McVitie would be the number one quarterback, would be the starter. That Carter Stanley has an opportunity at this point to still push for that job as we go into camp. You know, so it's definitely a possibility, but he didn't name any other guys that were kind of in the mix there. Other than to say, and this was a revelation to me because as recently as last week, I didn't even realize he had actually come to Kansas. But his son, Manny Miles, is a graduate transfer at this point, coming from North Carolina, is now on the roster, and as his dad put it, would be the number three quarterback, and then he quickly rephrased to be a backup quarterback. So it definitely sounds like, you know, they've got a number 1, 2, and 3, probably as it stands right now, that maybe there'll be a little bit of movement. But, I, you know, I'm a little surprised that, you know, some of the other guys we have on the roster maybe aren't getting a serious look. I don't know if it's because they're younger guys or just they haven't been as impressive for the type of offense that, you know, Miles wants to run. Or I should say less caning one wants to run. So are you surprised? Or are you more surprised that we have a fairly clear picture of what the quarterback depth chart looks like, or just more relieved that we have a somewhat clear picture?
I mean, I think deep down inside, we all knew who was going to be one and who was going to be two, at least to start the season. I don't think I really care who's 3 or 4 or 5. But I mean, you don't bring in a guy like McVitie, who at one point was the top JUCO quarterback recruit. Was he a 3 or 4 star kid coming out of high school? You don't bring in a guy like that and then he doesn't win the job, you know, for at least initially.
I think it was pretty, if you remember, because Bender, I believe, was the number four JUCO recruit. Now, granted, this is Beatty we're talking about, so that really wouldn't surprise
right.
me at all. But
right.
yeah, the way it should work, right? If you're bringing in one of the top, you know, top five JUCO quarterbacks as a transfer, you should be planning on him playing, because otherwise you wouldn't go out and recruit a guy
yeah.
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's not going to go somewhere where he's not going to maybe not have a guarantee, but where he's expecting to go in and start. Like, he's not going to come to Kansas if he didn't have some kind of idea that he would be the favorite, if that makes sense.
Right.
I wouldn't anyway. If it was me, I'd want to go somewhere where I could play for, you know, my final 2 or 3 years. I think McVitie has 2 years left.
I'm
not surprised that Stanley's the number two. And again, it's just a matter of time till it was made official. I think it's not surprising.
Yeah, I think Stanley was probably the only one who had a realistic shot at maybe pushing for the number one, only because he was a senior.
Right.
You know, and he has done a few things. So, but yeah, I mean, so I'm not necessarily too concerned at this point. Like, I'm just glad the fact that it seems like we have a plan at QB. We're not going to go into camp with we've got 3 guys, you know, that could potentially the famous quote that Scott Chasen was telling us about. Reminding us of on that last podcast episode that Beatty was
right,
talking about.
Right.
Oh, well, we don't have 2 QBs. We have 3 guys. All right. One other thing from the media days, Kansas specific, Khalil Herbert was asked about the running back room that they have there. And he was talking about how they have the best running back room in the nation. I believe he actually said,
which I think
is a little bit of hyperbole, but I do think they at least need to be in the conversation for one of the best running back rooms in the conference. Do you agree with that assessment? I think Puka is probably a starter at every other school in the Big 12, and Khalil Herbert and Dom Williams probably get serious consideration at being number one or number two on most rosters as well. Do you think that that's a fair assessment, or is that Khalil just being, you know, super hyped for his own guys?
Well, it's probably both, honestly. I sounds like hyperbole, but I don't disagree with him, at least in the conference. I don't know about the nation. You know, I don't know what – Clemson has, or Alabama has, or Ohio State has. Like, I don't know. But, yeah, Nation may be a bit of a stretch, but for sure, I think he's got a shot at the Big 12. I don't know. I'm not impressed by Texas's backs. So I just did a preview on them. Not impressed by – well, did Oklahoma – are they returning there? I don't even remember.
Are they returning?
Yeah.
Oh, the running back stuff?
The running back field.
I believe they have one coming back, but I don't remember if it's the leading rusher from last year or not. So,
yeah, I don't remember, but I definitely think it's fair. The three-headed monster of Puka, Khalil, and Dom is as good minimum as anybody else in the conference, and I think they could definitely compete to be heralded as one of, you know, the best in the nation, certainly in the top 20 or 25, without a doubt, I would think. Puka averaged 7 yards a carry last year. Here's another trivia question for you, Andy.
Go ahead.
Who are the only 2 Jayhawks to average over 6 yards a carry in their career?
I'm guessing, well, are we counting Puka so far as one of them?
No, not including Puka.
Okay, so not including current guys. I would imagine Gus Ayres is probably one of them.
That's absolutely correct.
Would the other one be John?
The other one here? No, you're gonna have to think back to your all-time great tournament that we did a couple years ago. It was actually Laverne Smith, the only two guys to ever average more than six yards carry at Kansas, and I believe they both averaged 6.5. So Puka is on pace to average more than Gale Sayers. Now, obviously, he's only done it for 1 year, and he did it as freshman. Sayers back then, freshman didn't play. He only did it as sophomore, junior, senior. But Puka's right there in terms of talent. He reminds me a lot, anyway, of like a Barry Sanders type guy. He's pretty good he's got good vision, the stop and start, the shiftiness. He's got all that stuff. And he's definitely the lightning to the thunder that is Khalil Herbert and Dom Williams, who are bigger backs. Not that they're necessarily slower. I mean, they might be a step or two slower than Puka, but, I mean, that's not really fair. Most people are. Yeah. But even those guys averaged over 4.2 yards per carry last year, which is a good clip. I don't see a weakness in the backfield unless, you know, legal troubles crop back in or injuries or something like that happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and looking around the rest of the conference, you know, David Montgomery from Iowa State, and then Justice from Oklahoma State, were like the two main guys that really were pushing Puka in terms of, like, you know, that was the clear top three last year. Puka's the only one to come back, you know, so he's clearly far and away, I think, the best running back returning. And now that they've kind of cleared up his situation, you know, it's definitely a whole lot easier. All right, we are running a little bit short on time. I'm going to go and throw it to one more quick break. We'll come right back. We're going to wrap up a few things and kind of just talk about some of the, you know, all the additional news that came out even while we were getting ready to record the podcast. So we will be right back on the Rock Chalk Podcast. All right, and we're back for our final segment here on this episode of the Rock Chalk Podcast. So one final question for you, Mike, and this is a non-KU related question. Specifically, what the other coach that kind of riled up the media at the beginning or in the first day of the Big 12 media days would have been Coach Lincoln Riley, talking about transfer rules, you know, Austin Kendall transferring over to West Virginia, you know, and he talked about how he didn't think that transferring in conference without losing a season or not necessarily a season of eligibility, but without having to sit out for a year. He didn't agree with that, but that for personal reasons, he was never going to not approve that particular transfer. And he got a lot of pushback, I think, from media, kind of people taking offense of multiple different areas of that. Some saying that he shouldn't have been talking about, you know, like, of course, guys should be able to transfer inside of conference and get waivers and all that stuff. And the other one's talking about, well, you know, why are your personal emotions kind of coming into this at all? Are you surprised first of all, what are your thoughts on the whole transfer rules, especially inside of conference?
Honestly, I think in general, the athletes should be able to transfer to any school they want without a redshirt year, without sitting out, without any kind of penalty like that. That said, it's dicey. In conference, if I was a coach, if I was Lincoln Riley, I wouldn't like that either, because he's going to know signals, he's going to know calls, he's going to know terminology, that can win or lose you a conference championship game or something like that. I would be okay with a 1 year sit out if you transfer within conference. I think it honestly used to be 2 years, didn't it, when the Big 12 was first formed?
I believe it was actually that you lost the transfer, or you had to sit out the year and you lost a year of eligibility, I think is what it was.
Is that what it was? Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's what it was. But, I'm okay with something in conference. But, I coaches can say, I mean, the Troy coach can go coach West Virginia and doesn't have to sit out a year. If a player wanted to transfer from Troy to West Virginia or vice versa, they should be able to do the same thing without having to sit out. So, I think players should be able to go around to wherever they want to go to school. Any other student can do that. If I wanted to transfer from Kansas to Michigan to for a degree or whatever, then I should be able to do that. Or, you know, But athletes can. That's the, and other sports, they can do it. You know, women's volleyball and softball and I don't know about baseball, but the, you know, some of the non-revenue sports, the athletes can transfer without having to use a redshirt year or having to sit out. So
that's not true.
They should be able to do that in football.
I know that most of the women's sports, they do have to sit out for the year. It depends on, well, but it's actually fairly similar in that it depends on the conference that you're in. You know, I think the main issues with the whole transfer situations right now are that the transfer, I think the rules need to be uniform. And I do think that it's just, you know, in conference definitely needs to be a little bit different because you're right. The teams are more familiar with each other. There's the potential, you know, you are going to be facing most of those teams most likely, you know, at least a lot sooner than you would in any other case. Like I could even make a case that if you transfer to someone who's, you know, to a school that's on the schedule for the next year. So like, for example, I forget there was one year where like the year that Oklahoma played Houston, if an Oklahoma player wanted to transfer to Houston, like, I don't know, you necessarily make him sit out the entire season, but you know, there is definitely some sort of competitive advantage to getting a guy that quickly, you know, and having him eligible. Now, most of that is probably going to be in game planning or in knowing some signals. But if, you know, if it was a guy that was playing on the defense and he knows all of the offensive signals because he went up against them in practice for 2 years, you know, like I could see that potentially being an issue. But then that also begs the question of, you know, the whole graduate transfer thing. You know, if a guy graduates from his school and wants to go to another school in conference, do you have the same sort of restrictions there? And if you don't, then why not? Because it's a similar type of situation, I think. And so, you know, it's all messy the way the transfer rules are set up. I do think, though, that the NCAA needs to come up with something that's more uniform, that, you know, it sets the rules for everybody. So we're not having this conversation at a conference level, and we're not trying to pressure a conference to make a decision that's different from all the other conferences. The NCAA needs to essentially do its job and decide what those rules should be. As for the emotional aspect of it, I think there was a lot of people that were talking about how he shouldn't have, you know, let his emotions affect the way that he was going to handle a player. And I don't think that's realistic. You know, Austin Kendall was essentially the first recruit that came to Oklahoma after Lincoln Riley took the job as the offensive coordinator. So, you know, it's not fair to really think that, you know, the guys that you've been there the entire time with, you know, you're going to have a closer relationship with the players that have been there longer. And so, you know, if you want these guys to do well, and we're going to probably let him go ahead and go, but still need to kind of make a statement about the general way that transfers are being handled. Like, I don't think he did anything wrong in initially opposing it, initially making that statement, and then ultimately coming to the decision that it was the right move to go ahead and let him go.
I don't have any problem with it.
Yeah. All right. So that's enough about all that other stuff. We'll go ahead and let you get out of here. Just some quick news that actually dropped right before we got ready to start the podcast. And this isn't something we'll talk about here, one, because it's so brand new, so I haven't even had an opportunity to really talk through it or think through it myself. And two, it's basketball related. You know, Dewan Harris was a four-star guard that is actually just committed to the Jayhawks tonight. He's expected to come in the 2019 class, so he fills that last scholarship that we have for the basketball team. You had mentioned it while we were talking beforehand, and I happen to agree. I have no idea how they're going to fit him in and how they're going to handle the playing time. We were worried about playing time issues long before he even committed. So we'll see how all that works out. I'm sure Bill Self will have a plan by the time we get there. Luckily, he has a little bit of time to think about it. But we'll try to have some sort of analysis of this the next time I talk with Fetch, which hopefully will be, you know, only in a week or two. But we will definitely talk about it some more once we have some thoughts on how to actually talk about it. There was one final thing, Mike, that I just remembered that I wanted to talk to you about. ESPN Plus, the Big 12 Now, which is the ESPN Plus network, and Kansas are working together to produce an 18-part miniseries that talks about the coaching search, the, you know, hiring of Les Miles, and kind of the behind the scenes look at the first year of Les Miles being head coach at Kansas. Oh, have you seen the trailer, and what are your overall impressions of this project?
I have seen the trailer. I'm going to watch it. I don't know how I'm going to watch it because I don't know what the heck Big 12 Now is. But
so
I do plan on watching it.
The ESPN Plus, the digital network that they have there, they've essentially just grouped all of their Big 12 coverage. It's going to be on the online-only platform and called it the Big 12 Now network, essentially. It'll be included with your ESPN Plus subscription if you have one. You should be able to catch all of the episodes online.
Well, I guess I better get that free trial, whatever they have, probably. But, anyway, I'll catch it one way or another. It looks interesting. I've seen a lot of people on Twitter talking about comparing it to Football Life or Hard Knocks. I don't think it's going to be something like that because from what I've seen, KU has editorial control over it. So it's going to be, I think, maybe more of a promo type documentary, I guess. Like, they're only going to show you the good parts. They're not going to show you, you know, I don't know what bad parts there might be, but they're not going to show you anything that doesn't paint the university in a good light, let's put it that way. But still, I'm excited to see it. I think it'll be a cool deal. I think it'll be cool for Kansas fans. I can't wait to hear K-State fans bitching about it.
Yeah. So from what I've heard, it sounds like it's going to be a lot like the one that the Chiefs are doing right now. I'm blanking on the name of it, but essentially it's, you know, it takes you behind the scenes in like the draft room and all of this other stuff. It's their own in-house kind of showing you what they want to show you about the program and
giving you
a peek behind the scenes, but they have full control editorially over what's in there. We're not going to get, you know, a bunch of dirt to come out of this. It's going to be essentially one big long hype video for the entire season that we have. The first four episodes will drop in August. From what I understand, it's all going to be at the same time, essentially, right before the season starts. And then they will do one episode per week throughout the week or throughout the year. So we'll get constant updates on this team. You know, there'll be additional information that will come out. We'll kind of get to see, hopefully, we'll get to see a lot of this team kind of growing into the coaching staff and the team that they have and how everything all comes together. It's definitely not going to be, you know, an objective look at all of it. It's going to be the school kind of, you know, hyping up all of the best parts about it. I'm sure that they'll have some things in there for drama purposes. You know, they'll have a few storylines in there that maybe you wouldn't necessarily think, but they have to hold the interest somehow. But it's not going to, you know, if there's any huge scandal that breaks or anything, you know, if something else comes out on Puka, for example, not that I'm expecting it to. But I highly doubt we would get any of those kind of details. It's more or less just going to be, you know, the peek behind the scenes that a lot of fans would want to see. It's really more of a marketing tool for the program. I would not be surprised if other teams decided to do something similar, you know, but it just kind of depends. You know, I think they saw the success that this Kansas City Chiefs won, and they've been talking about it, obviously, long before because it looked to have some very realistic footage of the Jeff Long coaching search. It seems to me from all the shots of Les Miles, you know, prior to being hired, it definitely looks to me like they went back and like shot all of those afterwards to kind of recreate or reenact some of that. Especially the very end of the promo there, it shows Les Miles sitting in a booth and he's like, oh, they got all that on camera, and gives that like aw shucks look of, you know, like wink, wink, we're all in on the joke here. I'm under the impression that Smacker Miles, his daughter, is heavily involved in this type of thing. She was hinting on one of the other KU podcasts, you know, that she had some projects that are kind of going on that will keep her close to the university and help her with her media career. So I wouldn't be surprised to find out that she's involved in this in some fashion. But it should be a good look. It should be an interesting show, if nothing else. That will kind of give us a little bit more information than we're used to getting. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. All right, Mike, any other final questions you want to tonight?
Yeah, I think peak is definitely the right word there. It's my understanding the episodes are only going to be about 18 to 20 minutes long. So it's, you know, it doesn't need to capture your attention for very long. I think it'll be cool, though. I definitely think that marketing tool is another apt description of what it's going to be. But I'm interested.
Yeah, definitely.
I can't wait to see it.
You know, at the very least, it's getting people talking about KU football again, which was kind of the entire point.
Yep. In a good way.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, we'll go ahead and leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you haven't already, you can find us pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, any of those major, and actually, I think we're even like Google Podcasts and all of that as well. So just search for Rock Chalk Talk. You can find us there. Subscribe. You know, give us a nice comments, a good rating, all that fun stuff. It really does help to get the podcast out there so that more people are listening and we can do more things for you guys. So, again, really appreciate it. If you guys want to get in touch with us, if you have questions for us, you want to have things you want us to talk about, any suggestions on guests you want us to try to bring on, you can contact us by email at rockchalkpodcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at rockchalkpod. You can also contact the main site that we have on Twitter as well, at Rock Chalk Talk. All of us are willing to interact and talk with you guys and answer questions and kind of do everything we can to share whatever information we might have. So, once again, thank you guys so much for listening, and we will catch you next time on the Rock Chalk Podcast.